Hello, I'm Katie Manning, and you're very lucky because you're listening to Gallifrey Public Radio. Enjoy!
I'm John from Game Life Balance US, a proud member of the Gunna Geek Network, just like the one you're listening to now. The opinions expressed are those of each individual. Check out all the other geeky podcasts at GunnaGeekNetwork.com. And get ready, because geekiness commences in 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to positive enjoyment of everything in the Doctor Who spectrum. Join us each week for discussions ranging from Hartnell to Whittaker and beyond. Your GPR hosts are Jay Witten.
Safety measures are for chumps who don't know what they're doing.
Keir Hansen.
Oh, hold on. I saw it on my mixer. I turned up the suck. Hold on.
And Haley Malley.
I feel like I might need to carb up for next week's episode.
Oh, and
spoilers.
We do discuss recent news, episodes that have already aired in their home territories, and the occasional interesting rumor. But don't worry, if we look too far into the future, we'll give you a fair warning.
Welcome to episode 267 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we found it much easier to generate these podcasts each week if we hand over complete control to the mighty computer. All hail Skype. Globalized huge profits. I'm Haley.
I'm Keir.
And I'm Jay, and step right up to the buffet, kids, because this week we're dishing up a steaming platter of high-protein fungus. Check the flypaper, and practice our Welsh pronunciation as we dial in the last story with the Third Doctor and Joe Grant, the Season 10 closer, The Green Death.
Yes, and joining us for the conversation on this this pivotal episode is our good friend and previous guest, Don Cleese. Don, welcome back to GPR.
Thank you, Keir. Happy to be back.
All right. Well, as we always do with these classic rewatches, we always want to get everybody's kind of, you know, quick off-the-cuff take, whether you've seen it 100 times and you're just, you know, bringing it back into the fold, or if you're just seeing it for the first time and trying to figure out what it is that you just witnessed over the past six episodes. Haley, we always use you as our initial stomping grounds. So knowing that we've been building this one up for a while, we didn't want to give you too much anticipation, but we couldn't help it, so we gave you a lot of anticipation. What was your take on The Green Death?
It was okay.
Okay.
I don't know. I feel like they almost made me like that doctor dude, and then, oh, nope, he's kind of a dick. And then, oh, for whatever reason, Joe's going to marry him. The end.
Rather abrupt. Yeah. Don, I know the Pertwee era being something that holds a special place in your heart. Where does this story fall in the pantheon of Pertwee stories?
Well, the thing is that as I was rewatching it, I had honestly forgotten how much I enjoyed it, because I think it's one of those stories that has become sort of a default example of peak Pertwee. And you're sort of supposed to like it if you're a fan of this era. And sometimes, as with anything you're supposed to like and supposed to find great, sometimes the virtues of it, you know, get lost along the wayside. But watching it again, I was like, wow, this is a really well-told, entertaining story, and a very thoughtful one at that.
Okay. Jay, how did you? What's your kind of knee jerk on this one?
This one will always have a special place in my heart, simply because it's one of the first classic episodes that I remember going back to watch as an adult, and so it's hard for me to separate myself from that kind of that kind of thought process throughout it. But it seems really, really ambitious in what they were trying to accomplish, and I'm not sure if it always delivers. I mean, there's definitely parts that are, you know, that are great to pick apart and things that you can always enjoy about it, but I'm just not sure if it lives up to what it was trying to accomplish.
Okay. I guess as I see it, knowing it's you know, its position within the season, the change that they knew that they had to, you know, bring forth when knowing that their that they have to write Joe out of the script by the close of this. I mean, the decision had been made that Katie was going to be going on to other projects. And Sloman had a lot of, I don't want to say necessarily an agenda, but he kind of did have an agenda of some things that he really wanted to incorporate into the story.
Did he care about environmental issues a little bit?
A little bit, but he actually was.
Where would you get that from?
If you when you see the interview with him where he's discussing it, I forget what anniversary it was. He actually the first thing that he pounces on is globalization before anything else. And the fact that, you know, he didn't like the idea of faceless corporate entities telling you where to work, what to eat, what to pay, and so on and so on. And everything else that went along with that sort of hinged off of it. You know, he said, and as a result of these poor decisions being made by these individuals who have lost touch with the common people, they end up poisoning the earth, poisoning the air, you know, and doing all of these other hideous things. So he said, you know, it's as if you're just being run by a mindless, a data source. Hence, Boss comes into existence. But yeah, I mean, we see from the outset of the first episode that we're really tackling green issues. Well, green issues. I didn't really mean it like that. But it's, yeah, I mean, it's done with a really heavy hand. I don't think that does the story any detriment, really.
Heavy-handed stuff is certainly not uncommon in that period. I think when they go for a message, when there's very little doubt in it, you know, that they're trying to make a point about, you know, with ecological issues or, you know, just the when you go into the reptile people whose names are frequently up to debate in past Pertwee stories, the whole element of who has proper claim to the earth and things like that. They're subtle is not usually on the agenda during the Pertwee era. Yeah. And, but I think they get away with it because they usually, yeah, frankly, because of all the gadgets and the, you know, bits of daring do. I mean, that's why, mm-hmm. like, you couldn't get away with these sorts of stories without, you know, action by havoc, you know, having the unit team and all of that element to kind of keep the plot moving. You have enough incident that if you are on the cusp of tuning out the heavy-handed message, you've still got something fun and exciting to watch on the screen to say, okay, it's still a fun story. We're not, we're not drowning in message.
Right, right.
And this one did have some solid pacing. That's not usually a feature of the six-part stories, but mm-hmm. I never felt while I was watching this one like, man, this whole chunk could have just gone.
Yeah.
That's a really good point. It is probably one of the rare six-part stories of that time that you're not thinking, well, they could probably cut out 5 minutes here and about six mm-hmm. minutes here.
Yeah. That whole third episode could go.
Yeah, yeah, I couldn't. A lot of times we start, you know, wondering, you know, which one is going to be, you know, Sophie's choice. Which episode would you take the axe to if you had to tighten it for time? And I don't really know if any of these, because of the way that that some of the key points of progressing the story and getting some really important things from both your primary and your supporting characters throughout, I don't really know if any of them could suffer that loss.
You know, it's there was definitely. I think that it could be tightened to less episodes than six, but not that there was a whole episode. Like, it's just modern pacing kind of stuff would dictate that some of the things would get cut out or that it would move a little faster. But I mean, it never once felt like it was like, oh, they're just putting this in there so that we reach the six episode count.
Right. Some of that is probably in large part because even though it is a fairly long run through six episodes, you've got a single writer, single director, mm-hmm. so it's you don't suffer that instance of having somebody brought in as the closer, you know, on the script and is handed something that has been taken, you know, eight innings deep, and now you got to figure out, well, what am I going to do with this, and I have to wrap it up in 22 minutes. And I think Sloman had a very distinct vision of what it was that he wanted to put forth. And I think Michael Bryant recognized that. Some of the editing is actually really clever, too. There's moments where from scene cut to scene cut, there's like a carryover line, you know, and things like that, where mm-hmm. I'm blanking on some of the actual instances, but there may be something like saying, they're going to be coming out of the woodwork, and then they cut to the next scene, and there's the brig saying they're going to be coming out of the woodwork, and it just everything just kind of flows really nicely. The brig, incidentally, this story is one of the ones that puts this poor man through the ringer. He has to be action hero and diplomat and comedy relief and throughout. But mm-hmm. at least he drives a sweet Mercedes.
Also, his hair is getting very poofy.
It is getting a little poofy. It did, it got a little wingy at the sides.
Not quite regulation.
No.
Yeah. Not quite.
This is true. Although, speaking of hair and poofiness, Pertwee loved doing a lot of his own stunts whenever possible, but there was that first throwdown where it kept, where he was tossing guards and working his Aikido, where every time they would cut, you would think that after all of the sequences that they'd shot with him over the course of the previous seasons, that they would have gotten a wig that actually matched his hair color.
Nah.
But, no. Nah. Anyway.
They used what they already had in storage, and that's what they had.
I guess so. But speaking of things like incorporating great elements into this, I'm always a big fan of any time they go back to Wales because give me Welsh accents all day long. That's absolutely fine. Yep. But working this, all of the oddity of the Doctor's time on Metabilis as we're getting this thing off the ground.
Maybe that could have gone.
No, I loved it.
Well, but you know what? We've talked obviously a lot about Robert Sloman as the writer, but I think it's worth mentioning. I think that while he was obviously receptive to those environmental issues, a lot of that was driven by Barry Letts, because they worked very closely together. And Letts most people with an opinion who kind of have some standing to know seem to suggest that the script was probably as much coming out of Barry Letts' viewpoint as it was Robert Sloman's. And I think Barry Letts was probably the most ambitious, at least during the quote unquote classic era, in terms of world building and trying to use the every bit of technical trickery he could manage at BBC Television Center to create these, try to create this larger environment. And definitely, I can't say that all of the stuff of Metabolis 3 comes off probably the way it was intended to. Certainly not the way it was probably received somewhat more generously at the time, more charitably at the time by the viewers. But there's no faulting the ambition of really trying to, create an alien environment. And
I bought it. I mean, I love the fact that you get into these intense colors. It's really. I mean, the jarring nature of jumping from location to location was obviously very clear. And they were really. You talk about technical aspects. They were really trying to do. Obviously, you could tell that this was a final story for the season because they were pulling out all the stops. You had plenty of explosions. You had more chroma key than I think was even necessary. I mean, there were scenes where they were green screening it, where you thought, wouldn't it just be easier just to walk outside for a second and just shoot this out in the lot?
Like when they had a guy going down an elevator, like you couldn't just put a guy standing on an elevator?
No, I don't know. But they would have scenes where you had Bessie would pull up and the Doctor's having a quick exchange with Benton and the brig, and you can tell that they've chroma keyed it in because there's just a couple of pine trees in the background that are a little kind of dodgy around the edges and such. And then they cut to the scene of the Doctor driving away, and it's actually shot on location from the nearest hillside, up a race. Like it's kind of strange. I mean, I know everything had its rationale, and I wouldn't even begin to understand why they made some of the decisions that they did. But I liked the fact that for a little while, the maggots were pretty good models. I mean, those were when they got the close-ups of those mouths. Those nasty-looking little buggers.
Oh yeah.
The professor's tray of fungus, though, when he's working on it, I'm like, you just took a can of red spray paint to a bunch of button mushrooms in here and said, oh, I'm working on a new derivative. It is. Oh, it's like the mushrooms you'd be toadstools you'd be eating at the store. Like, well, okay. But that gets us it gets us into Jo's final episodes and everything that she poured into this. You know, we've been talking for weeks about how her character had been getting more and more three-dimensional and more nuanced and interesting, and her relationship with the Doctor was getting deeper and more genuine, and the off-screen chemistry that fed on-screen and everything that amplified with it. This was the apex of it. How did we feel about how they kind of telegraphed her exit from the first two episodes? I said you kind of knew by about the second episode that something funky was going on. Mm-hmm. Haley, how did you feel about this?
It was okay, I guess. I mean, I'm fine with them telegraphing it. If it's all one story, it's okay to know from the beginning where the end of the story is heading. Mm-hmm. The Doctor was a jerk by the end. Like, you know, at the beginning, it's established, like, oh, this is something she would be interested in doing. She would love to go on this trip to the Amazon and do this thing. Mm-hmm. I feel like she could have done that without marrying this random Doctor guy.
Okay. The marriage proposal that took everyone, including her, by surprise. Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh. It's like, she's known this guy for a day, and she's going to marry him? No.
But look at that hair, though. Yes. Why not?
Yeah, and they did share a life or death experience together, which, you know, has a tendency to, you know, kind of bring people together.
I'm saying you can get married after you go on your trip to the Amazon.
Well, you know what's a funny thing though? I was again when I was watching this again last week, it had been a while since the last time I saw it, and I wanted to be properly prepared. And I was one thing I was struck by. Well, first off, let me just to Haley's point, this is. Perhaps it's perhaps a step up from the Doctor's granddaughter going off with David what's his face in Dalek Invasion of Earth, but not by that much, perhaps.
Well, it is exactly one step up because she could have left with the random dude she met on that other planet like two stories ago.
Well, that's true. Yeah, Planet of the Daleks. That very good point. But I think what is very
or she could have stayed with the Paladin of Peladon.
Well, yeah.
There have been a lot of instances where they've been trying to pawn Joe off on people all through time and space.
Well, and we should talk at some point about how Mike Gates feels about all this. But the thing I was going to thinking about was that, you know, in that first episode was very striking is the Doctor basically offers Joe, and I think he maybe uses pretty much these words, offers her pretty much anywhere in time and space. And Joe's kind of like, no, I got to do something right now. And it's very interesting because compare that to, you know, flash forward to 2005 and, you know, Rose Tyler was like, ooh, time and space. Excellent. You know, it's very interesting. That's sort of how, you know, like, you know, looking back on it now with that sort of hindsight, it's like, here's how, you know, the companion's ready to go. Time and space, not a big deal. You know, whereas, you know, in those early, you know, early exciting days, like that's the most awesome thing imaginable. So, so yeah, you know that Joe is in a bit of a different mindset now.
Yeah, and that's but I like the fact that you've seen that building. Like you've seen her horizons expand, and as a result, she's more cognizant and more dialed into things going on that she feels have more relevance and importance to her personally and her moral standing. So I like the fact that this was the thing, because she had always they dropped hints in stories prior. Maybe this was Letts sort of channeling a little bit through her and allowing some of his statements or his inner monologue come through to a certain degree, that he wanted to instill this character with some of this. But now it didn't seem like it was coming out of left field for her.
Right.
The fact that this becomes environmental concerns, that this becomes a societal concern, and yes, and this is where she draws the line in the sand. She's like, this is something that's important to me. This is a hill that I'm willing to die on, and I'm going to go forth with this. I'll leave UNIT. I'll do all these things. I'll step away from the Doctor. That you can look at that and say, okay, I see where this was coming from. This is not a left field decision. This is not some sort of a, you know, quick write something in where Joe suddenly cares about bees and is going to go keep bees in Coventry. So.
Right. Well, I think it's a thing that's important. I've kind of got a lot of this in my mind because a couple months back I was asked to write a piece about Planet of Spiders for the Doctor Who Appreciation Society's magazine, and that kind of just got me thinking about the Pertwee era in general. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that really sticks out when you think about it is that Pertwee's time in the show is really the only period where you act, where you have basically the entire production team, you know, producer and script editor in place for that whole time, that they could really kind of, you know, plan out. Obviously, it's not planned out maybe to the same extent that we've seen in recent years, you know, in the 21st century revival. But as far as, you know, as far as a producer and in tandem with the script editor being able to say, you know what, let's make sure we're building up some of these elements so that when we have this character go, the audience will feel that it wasn't just a random departure like Liz Shaw going back to Cambridge off screen, but rather the something that feels right within the context of a story. Because there is kind of this, it's not heavy-handed, but there is a larger story going on, you know, during Pertwee's time. I mean, there are recurring elements that, you know, kind of, as you see from, you know, going up through eventually Planet of the Spiders, that there's, you know, I hate to use the term character arc because it's so screenwriting 101, but, you know, a lot of these things are there. And you see it with Joe, you see stuff, you know, with Mike Yates, even, you know, Brigadier to some extent. You know, it wasn't quite as episodic. You know, it wasn't, you know, it was definitely treading that line between the, you know, here's what's going on in the story of the week, but also some attention to how audiences were seeing the characters over time.
Okay. Well, Haley, you had said that some of the aspects of the final moments between Doctor and Joe as we get down to the close of the sixth episode left you feeling like you had kind of rolled things back, like as if the relationship had suddenly just regressed, and the Doctor had sort of taken on his haughty or nearly kind of dickish tones.
I said that? No, yeah. No, not the Doctor. The doctor she's going off to marry. Yeah, the professor.
Cliff. Professor. Okay. All right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Jones. Yeah. Him. I did not like. No. I like where things leave off with the Doctor and Joe. I like that she made the choice that, you know, this part of her life is done. She's going to go and do her own next thing. She wasn't forced out by circumstance or the Doctor deciding that she shouldn't go on this journey anymore. It was her decision. I really liked all of that about it.
Okay. Did it seem jarring to anybody? We talk about the fact that we all kind of appreciated some of the flow and the way the each of the episodes kind of carried relatively well, you know, decent cliffhangers, you know, from episode to episode. Don't think we had any that were particularly weak, but there was only one point through, I think, probably the entirety where every time I see it, it just seems like I'm missing a scene. And it's right after, what's his name? I can't remember. Ralph Fell, aptly named Ralph Fell, gets told that he has to basically kill himself. And he goes racing, you know, down the corridor, past the Doctor and Joe, and goes up the stairs, over the railing, and flings himself. They go and they look over the railing, and they see him down there, splattered. And then 7 seconds later, they're kicking it back at a party at the Nut Hutch, sucking down elderberry wine and telling stories. Did that seem like there was something missing in between? I would have thought that would have weighed a little more on Joe's shoulders.
No, I mean, definitely, like, the first time I remember watching it, I was like, is this, like, alternate reality or something? Kind of, I mean, it feels so disconnected.
Yeah. I gotta wonder if there's I'll have to see if there's anything out there that discusses whether there was an editing decision or a quick script change or something that led to that.
Or did they, like, reorder some scenes or something, maybe? That would take a second viewing.
For timing? Because they needed to fill something out to the 25 minutes, or, like, you know, they had to, like, you know, do some jiggery-pokery with the order of things.
Yeah. Because it just – and that – because that whole time – in fact, that whole sequence, that when you're bringing them back to that whole dinner party, and you got the Nancy's doing – I don't remember if it was Nancy. Whoever was doing yoga and was, you know, flipped over. You got a guy carving clay in the back. You got – I mean, and then we're living the whole commune thing, the scientific art commune. But the whole scene felt – weird, and the fact that didn't you just realize that you just had your consummate evidence that there is some really dangerous stuff going down at Global Chemicals right now, and you've actually seen lives lost. But hey, the wine's fantastic, and the Briggs enjoying his, you know, quick, you know, smoking a pancake there at the head of the table. I just couldn't wrap my head around it. And they're, you know, playing the gags about, you know, the brig just ate fungus and, you know, that old chestnut. That
right.
Do you see any cows?
Exactly. Well, I don't know. So I will want to make sure that, you know, obviously addressing our big bad in this as the boss was, I think, a rather interesting thing to pursue. It wasn't just your supercomputer. We weren't dealing with, you know, Nomad or something like that. But it had, obviously, with John Durth's persona behind it. Haley, I will actually pose you this, because I threw two other people who were watching this for the first time over this past week, that the moment they first heard the boss speak in Stevens's office on the monitor,
thought it was the master.
Yes, it's exactly where I was going with it.
There was that, and also when they pulled out those headphones, I thought they might be doing something with the Cybermen.
Me yes, too. I was wondering, like, at the time, did people think, oh, Cybermen, you know, because we haven't seen them for a while.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that maybe there was some intent to that. Maybe they just wanted to say, do a little pump fake and, you know, see who they could keep kind of dialed in on that. But I love the balance between the boss and Mr. Stevens, and the fact that the boss kind of goes a little hinky towards the end there, after the doctor, you know, plays with him with that classic riddle, and he kind of, you know, slips a gear a bit to the point where he's kind of singing to himself, and Stevens is actually trying to talk him back onto the program and such. I really enjoyed it. I thought that was a great dynamic to add to the story.
Well, it's sort of a great villain too, because, you know, Pertwee's doctor has been set up as, you know, that bureaucracy is the, you know, his number one sort of, you know, forget the master. It's like, you know, the doctor can kind of relate to the master. It's the bureaucrats he can't stand the most of all. And Boss kind of just embodies that, you know, in sort of its in its literally least human sense.
Right. And he does have a genuine disdain for computers as well. He loves mechanics. He loves operational things, you know, and he loves getting into the guts of things. But I don't think he particularly likes computers. It seems like he always has these instances where he's referring to something as a, you know, a trumped up abacus or who knows what.
Right.
To be fair, most of the computers he meets are evil.
This is true.
Yeah.
That's pretty much a truism for the doctor. You know, one thing that was funny too, as I'm watching it, I'm wondering, were the people who made, did the people who made the Captain America movie Winter Soldier see this episode? Because Boss, in the way it's presented, especially in that cliffhanger from episode 4 and episode 5, reminds me a lot of the way Arnim Zola was portrayed in Winter Soldier, when Captain America and the Black Widow go to that, you know, old, you know, abandoned base in New Jersey, and, you know, the computer is literally everywhere.
I can absolutely see that parallel. Well, I will say, I've mentioned this on numerous occasions, as we're referring to the boss here, that the title sequences and the opening credits to the Pertwee era are probably my baby's absolute favorite. Nothing will stop him in his tracks faster, even if he's in the middle of a complete raging tirade across the living room. All I need to do is quick, and I have it on quick cue. It's like on a YouTube watch later thing, so I can call it up on immediate notice if I have to, and just play that opening sequence, and that normally stops him in his tracks. Well, Boss apparently is equally interesting. A giant red ball with wavy lines all over it has the equivalent amount of infant fascination factor. So, you know, he's got that going for him. You know, if the global domination thing doesn't work out, he can take over the infants of the world. All right, so technical aspects. Actually, I'm going to stick a pin in that for a second, because I just want to take a moment to absolutely address probably the second appearance within the Pertwee era of my absolute favorite supporting character, and that's Dave the Miner, played by Talfrin Thomas. Probably the best Welshman ever put on television in the history of ever. also known as Talf the Teef, because he has that tremendous kind of buck-toothed overbite. But if you remember, he was the miner that got sent down, or that stayed on the surface, that kept trying to help them as they were trying to slow down the cable as the elevator was plunging. So, but you had seen him also as Mullins, the hospital attendant in Spearhead from Space, the one who ratted out.
Yes.
The, Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yes. And you can't mistake that face, that mug. And they did, it was actually, who did the, they did on the DVD release, they did a little extra segment where they returned to the location where they were doing all the shooting. And Mark Gatiss was doing it as an expose thing. He gave himself some fake name, slapped a mustache on his face, not unlike one that he just wore a couple of weeks ago, and was doing this thing called Global Conspiracy, ? Where they were saying that the boss and Stevens had actually survived the explosion and were being hidden as a part of a government cover-up. But they were both being used for other projects on behalf of the ministry and such. But they had Telford Thomas there just as a local, speaking about the strange things that had happened back however many years ago. And he's there wearing like this white members only jacket with a pink cravat tied around his neck, and he's doing like this effeminate Welsh accent, and it's bizarre, absolutely bizarre. But just having a couple more minutes of this guy, oh, it's very exciting. Oh, the strange things were happening over there. You couldn't believe it. Was a phenomenal. It was like Christmas again for me personally. So another reason to pick up the DVD set. From a technical aspect, though, I mean, we were talking about the fact that they did a whole lot of chroma key. We had helicopter action. We had a lot of explosions. We had grenades being thrown down because that's the best way to carpet bomb an area, apparently, is to throw HE
Benton
grenades.
Was in heaven, with all those grenades.
He was having a field day. Ben had great stuff in this one. This was a great story for John Levine, I think. I think he's and also, well, all right. I want to back up 1 second. I know we're talking technical stuff, but Haley, did you cotton on to what was happening with Yates when he was undercover, or did you think you missed something?
When he first showed up, I thought, oh, did he leave Unit 2? Like, are they writing him out of the show
right.
And he's going into the private sector?
Well. All right, and then this is going to cue up something. And Don, and I, you had alluded to this, and I want to sort of dig into this deeper because I don't feel that they gave him enough of an opportunity to really react to the news that Joe was abruptly married. Because I've watched that scene over and over and over and over, and I keep wanting to see Yates gutted. I know it sounds horrible, but I wanted to see him react further. And I know they've corrected that. Not posthumously, but well after the fact in extended materials. But why do you think they didn't really give that enough room to breathe at that exact moment?
Was Sloman aware of the history between those two?
I would imagine that with the creative overseers between Barry Letts and Terry Dix and stuff sort of looking over the shoulder, they would have said, yeah, you might want to give this a beat. Just to hang there. And I know we're trying to sort of speed ourselves towards a heartfelt goodbye between Joe and the doctor, but this kind of matters too. We've been toying around with the relationship between these two for years. So let's give this a half a second. But I don't think they even... I don't know.
There's bits of it. I mean, one thing I found very... because I was watching particularly with that in mind, and was that, I do think it's very interesting that Yates is literally the first person to congratulate them when they break the news. And I think it's also interesting too, that, that the first thing that then is said to Mike afterwards is, do you need a drink? So it's, I think Pertwee as I was saying earlier, I think Pertwee's tenure was probably the most that the production team was really thinking in terms of character development, because it was really the only time they had more than two, regular characters to kind of focus on and on a season by season basis. So I think they were always trying to tread that line carefully to have things going on with the characters, kind of move them along. Mm-hmm. But they may have also just said, we can't have two. They may have been thinking, well, look, let's not push our luck. Let's not overdo this relationship that we never really built up as much as we probably should have anyway. I mean, I know certainly, Richard Franklin has made it clear that he kind of came on board with the understanding that his character was supposed to be a love interest for Joe. But, you know, I think for whatever, I think it's the show that probably also, you know, kind of dovetailed with the production team thinking, you know, we kind of got to get them away from Earth a little more.
Right.
So they really never had that opportunity.
Well, and for those that choose to pursue it further, you will continue to be able to see Yates's, I was about to say exploits, but that would be a really horrible choice of words. But Yates's choices beyond this point, after realizing that he's been sort of unrequited in this regard, because it does get kind of interesting if you want to chase that down. Anything else as far as from a technical perspective that you thought either caught your attention either in a good way and said, wow, okay, well, I'm really surprised they were able to do that in 1973, or that sort of pulled you back for a second and said, you know what, that did not hold up.
Well, Benton seems to be reacting to the sonic screwdriver noise at least a beat before it's activated, you know, when the doctor's using it to immobilize the maggots. But
he was probably much closer to the screwdriver than we at the camera, so the sound hit him first.
Yeah. Good point.
Yeah. Screwdriver did get a lot of good use in this story. It really came around.
It actually made sense, yes.
Yeah.
The one thing that I thought was that always stood out to me anytime I try and like put myself in the mind frame of the 70s and whatnot is the doctor describing Metabolus 3 and then actually getting a chance to see him there and like the way that that everything is just blue washed. Like it's I know it's a very simple process nowadays, but thinking about like back in the 70s and stuff, it does give it that feel that he was describing that you know, you feel like he is on a different world, not just some sound set that, you know, has a blue filter over it.
Yeah. Even just referring to that, I love the fact that as that whole sequence got launched off, you know, he lands there and he's looking over this beautiful horizon. And it's like something out of, you would expect to see Douglas Adams kind of penning a scene like this. Because like as the doctor looks out and notices the twin suns setting over the blue coastline, a large tentacle reaches out and grabs him lovingly about the throat. You know, that's what I wanted. I mean, that sets that whole bizarre sequence off, and I loved it.
Yeah, and it's one of those things like, yeah, it was meant to be comedic relief. It was meant to kind of just, you know, we need a break. Here's something else that's kind of fun, whatever. And it worked really well for that aspect, but it wasn't overdone. It didn't overshadow the story they were trying to tell. It was just kind of like, hey, let's check in and see what the doctor's doing right now. Oh, yep. Another random monster trying to eat him. and that was it. And you never saw the outcome. You never saw how he got out of it. It wasn't a, you know, here's the doctor's adventures kind of things. It's just, it was very simple and very well done. And I loved it.
Yeah. Didn't they even have like a sort of a setup line that said something about, oh, I'm sure he's up to something right now. And it cuts really quickly to the doctor running for his life. And then it cuts back.
Yeah.
Again, it was just a lot of these sort of these cue setups that were just absolutely brilliant.
Well, it's funny, too, that they really had no purpose for the doctor, you know, in the early stages of the story proper. Hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, it's almost like, well, we got to get him off. You know, we got to get him off somewhere else so that
and Joe, we don't want him to just can be working on the TARDIS again.
Right? You know, they couldn't do that anymore. It's like, man, it's like once he actually had the TARDIS working again, they you know, they were out of excuses.
Well, it's unfortunate to a certain degree that we've reached the close of this particular pairing. I mean, we are on the cusp of something absolutely extraordinary as far as I'm concerned. It's just very near and dear to me personally, as for what's around the corner as we get towards the Time Warrior in a couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think this was an excellent close between the two. I think they both left on very good standing. I like the fact that it was a very quiet, introspective closing seconds right before the credits. I can't remember the last time.
A beautifully shot too.
Yeah. It's just, you know, the silhouette, the Bessie driving off, and then it's just a very, it's just like 7 seconds of quiet before the credits start to roll. And I can't remember the last time they did anything like that where it wasn't end on a punchline or end on a, you know, on something brash. This was
You could see another episode or another cut of this episode ending at the party with everybody laughing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And well, Joe, you know, noticing the doctor slip out the door.
Well, yeah, you know what I love too, that beautiful symmetry of Joe having called her uncle to get the Nuthutch designated as the priority research facility, and the whole that bit of business between her and the doctor, where she talks about how it was only the second time she asked her uncle for anything, and you know, the first obviously being getting the job at UNIT, and excuse me, again, just really speaks to that whole tying up of a storyline of you know, that here was a, you know, that sense of this was all, even though clearly the Joe and Cliff relationship feels completely jerry-rigged, but the sense of her as a character kind of having reached some sort of culmination.
Mm-hmm. Oh, not to mention the fact that she gained a lot of on-the-job skills because she was able to put the walkie-talkie back together, too. That's she never true, would have been able to do that at the beginning of their relationship.
Very good point.
So she's been paying attention over the shoulder as the doctor's been tinkering with all these wine bottles and things that he's been assembling. all right, so we get to the fun little segment here where we get to talk about rewatchability and recommendability. Haley, you know the drill. So where would you put this one in the sequence?
I would definitely rewatch it. Definitely recommend it. I feel like it's an important part of the story for Pertwee's Doctor, for the Third Doctor, because Joe is such a big part of his journey. You can't cut her departure out of any rewatch or recommendation.
Okay, all right. Jay, what about your take on these?
I mean, it's always rewatchable. It's a lot of fun, even if it is heartbreaking at times. And but I love the story. It's one of my favorites of the classic era. And so yeah, absolutely rewatchable. And like Haley says, it's you have to recommend it. You know, as long as it's following other stories, like you know the Third Doctor and you know Joe, then yes, absolutely they need to watch it. But it would be kind of hard to come into this, as I did, not knowing either one of them.
Yes. Yeah. No, I absolutely agree with that. Don, just to kind of give you the backstory here. So as you probably ascertained, we like to discuss how rewatchable the particular story is in the grand scheme of all the ones that you could from that doctor or from that season or from that era. And then obviously as far as recommendability is sort of, you look at it twofold. It's not only, you know, is it something that you would actually hand to someone else and say, you know what, this is really a good one. You're going to enjoy this if you've seen any Pertwee. But then you could also extrapolate it and say, if you're handing somebody the Pertwee must-haves, would you include this in the set?
Yeah, well, I would definitely include it in the set. It wouldn't necessarily be the first one, because I think as you know, as Jay was pointing out, you probably need a little bit of grounding in the relationship between the Doctor and Joe. So, you know, that's so yeah. So, you know, it's kind of like you wouldn't introduce someone to Peter Davison's Doctor with Caves of Androzani. It would just be wrong. But yeah, I think you it's definitely, I think in the pantheon, kind of a key story. You know, well, I think also one that it would probably be closer. It was only after rewatching it that I think it really hit me that it would probably be closer to the top of the list as far as stories that I would recommend to someone who maybe is only familiar with the more, you know, current episodes but wanted to dip their toe in the water a bit of some older stories, because I think it's one that it doesn't suffer from the languid pacing that a lot of particularly six-part episodes do, and I think it also has those elements of characterization and character development that, again, we sort of take for granted in the Davy/Moffat iteration of the show, and maybe don't associate with the 70s version of it. So I think it's great for that reason.
Not to mention some familiarity with as far as some of the social messages and the underpinnings to the story that have become pretty recognizable or pretty expected within modern Who. This is one where you can say, all right, I've got some familiar territory because this is actually still relevant today.
Well, the computer trying to take over the world. I mean, you know, thinking about that, that's a really, that's pretty much, that I'm thinking like Bells of St. John or, you know, some of the more modern episodes. As a plot, I mean, obviously it would be much more concise, even if it's done as a two-parter, but still, that idea of the you know, the whole idea that Boss is going to take over the world via some sort of linkage, you know, obviously the internet was not envisioned in anything like it is today back in the time the Green Death was made. But you could very easily transplant that plot line into the current, you know, production format, and it wouldn't seem weird at all.
I think I don't remember which book it was, but I think there was a book that actually suggested that the boss was, what was that? How did they have it worked out? I think they had said that the original designs, or that the creator, was it the creator for the boss, was built from funding provided by Tobias Vaughn.
That would not surprise me. Probably one of the New Adventures books.
And then you could actually take that even further and say that maybe the boss had something to do, if the boss did survive, or if any remnants of the boss actually survived the explosions, was responsible for the development of Gus. Because we've been trying to figure out where Gus came from ever since. So your Mummy on the Orient Express and the continuation of the not exactly benevolent supercomputers. But yeah, I would agree. Rewatchability is an absolute slam dunk. Recommendations, I would include it within my top five Pertwee stories. Give somebody, you know, some things like, you know, Spearhead and such to get established, and then give me another story in there, maybe one or two other stories to establish the importance of Joe and that relationship, maybe from the earlier stories of their pairing, so you can kind of see how far she comes, or maybe even Peladon. I don't know. I'll have to go back and kind of think about that one. But this would be in there to kind of round out and say, and then this is how far their relationship has progressed. This is how the Third Doctor deals with the departure of a dear friend, because I think that's pivotal to the understanding of some of his of his mindset and his interpersonal relationships on a day-to-day basis, as opposed to, you know, the way that he, you know, his moral compass on the grand scale and the protection of the many. This is his concern for the one. And not to mention the fact that it's kind of all around a relatively engaging, and as we've been saying, a well-paced story, start to finish. Yeah. So yeah, I like it. All
right. Well, are we ready to get into the news?
I think we shall. We shall. A couple of pieces. It's been a little bit of a quieter week, but there has been some interesting stuff coming around. So sort of take these in some order here. I included this because we're still sort of closing the books on Stephen Moffat and everything that he has been attempting of late. And some of the decisions we were trying to figure out about his work with his final season of Doctor Who, with what he's been doing with Sherlock. He's working on this other sort of vampire story that's, you know, in whatever stage. Apparently there was something else that was also on the books that he was going to do and just simply didn't have the capacity or the time. He was going to get back into sitcoms, or at least a comedy. I don't know if this was a sitcom by definition. But had anyone else heard about this, or was this surprised everybody else too?
Yeah,
I had not
heard about this.
No, I had not heard about that.
Okay. So apparently he had something in the works that had already been greenlit. Like, he was ready. He could have gone forward with it if he could figure out how to get enough time in the day. But it was actually Sue who sat down and said, look, let me plot this out for you, and you're going to see that you physically cannot do all these things at one time without something seriously suffering. And he had this idea for some sort of a comedy called Adam and Eve that had to do with a boss and his primary assistant. So I guess it was going to be this relationship comedy, but I don't really know. I mean, I don't know if he's done. Has he done anything that was just a straight up comedy since Coupling?
Not that I'm aware of. No,
I don't think so. No, I mean, he went from Doctor Who, and then Jekyll, and then kind of back in, you know, back into Doctor Who again.
Yeah. Yeah. By the way, reading the story just kind of poked me in the brain and said, I think I have the opportunity now. It's downtime. We have until the fall of 2018 before we got Doctor Who back. I'm going to go back and rewatch Coupling, because I want to see if it holds up to what I remember. I mean, as far as the snappy dialogue, the kind of clever character interactions, and Jeffrey, the Welshman.
Oh, indeed. And also, you know, probably be a lot of fun to look for the Doctor Who references, because I remember there being quite a few, but I suspect there were. I wasn't even thinking of them at the time.
That's true. Yeah. All right. I'm keen to that. Yeah, I might have to. All right. If I do so, I'll tweet it out so everybody knows, and if they wanna chime in on it as well, and we'll do it and we'll take it apart. We'll see how far Moffat has progressed as far as.
Well, you know. Well, funny thing. A few years ago, I was at a TV business thing, and with someone from BBC Worldwide introduced me to the man himself, because he happened to get on the same elevator, and which was weird because we had literally just been talking about him. And I was, you know, didn't know what to say, you know, say to him without seeming like a gibbering idiot. And I mentioned how much I liked Coupling, which was my introduction to him. I think it was many people's. Mm-hmm. And he swore to me that he could just pick up the show again if he wanted to. Like, if he wanted to start doing it again, he could. He said, he's like, everybody looks exactly the same as they did back then, except for
that's
me.
That's true.
You know, and it's like, so, you know, of course, now I'm thinking, is he going to do that? Because Lord knows, in the, you know, BBC is certainly not averse to reviving things that have a, you know, some sort of track record mm-hmm. of late. So, I mean, yeah. If they can get Richard Coyle back as Jeffrey, you know, I'm in, you know.
That's true. Well, that was their detriment for that final season, right? Because they lost him in the final season, and that's when I stopped watching.
I made it through, but I can't say I was heartbroken that there was not a series 5 at the time.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, well, next piece we've got on here is just it's a feel good for a lot of reasons, because now we have finally reached, call it another milestone, I guess, that Jodie Whittaker has been announced as, is the Doctor on the cover of Doctor Who magazine. Yeah. In case you didn't know.
Kind of shocking.
Yeah.
Surprised everybody.
But it leads into some great material inside. I know a lot of us here in North America have to get our DWM on a bit of a delay, or physical copy anyway. But that's so that you can cut out all the pictures and make your collages to put up on your bedroom wall, obviously, right?
Yeah, collage. That's a nice word for it.
Collage. Shrine. Whatever you want to do with it. That's fair. And for you cosplayers out there, yeah, you get some accurate representations of the true color of the coat. Thank you very much.
Because that's been certainly that has been that's been up there with like that, you know, the woman with the dress. Like, what color is this dress? That's
precisely
Jodie's costume has been up there as well.
Yeah, not to mention people will get a closer look at the earrings that she's wearing, and they can do the whole thing. So I expect everybody's cosplay game to now reach an entirely new level as a result of this particular write-up. But the article itself is rather engaging as well. It leads us into our last piece. Everybody's been chiming in on what they feel this means for the next iteration within the Doctor Who franchise, the fact that we've just broken through another barrier, that we've got what seems to be one more step towards a truly open representation of anyone could be the Doctor and everyone can see themselves in the Doctor, and the Doctor is for everyone. They finally get a chance to talk to Jodie about it specifically. And I know that she's alluded to this in a lot of interviews, but I like the way that she's had a lot more time to really kind of process this now. I think she's starting to really draw some conclusions, and they're very eloquent about the way she feels her role in this all is. Not only who she is as an actor, you know, working on her CV and, you know, and coming into it with the skill set that she believes that she has. And she's extremely humble. I mean, she's dangerously humble. But also the fact that she understands what this represents. And that's why I'm really glad to hear this from her. And the fact that she's so cognizant of it, because I think that means that she's going to be putting 110% into this at every single possible moment. Did everybody get a chance to kind of read this over?
Yeah.
So, yeah, Haley, how did it strike you? I mean, knowing what you thought she would say versus what she actually said.
It sounds very similar to a lot of discussions we ourselves have been having.
Mm. Okay. What in particular was really kind of rising to the surface for you?
Well, this one in particular, I'm pretty sure I've heard these words come out of your mouth, that she can be a role model for young people, boys and girls. Because one of the negative things we've heard is that, oh, young boys are losing a role model. And I know we and other people in our circles have said, no, they haven't.
Yeah. Who's to say that a role model for you has to have exactly the same biological construct? So, yeah, I picked up on the same line. There's other stuff in there, and I know this is an excerpt. I think the Fuller article might have come – was this IO9's original article, or was this Digital Spy who actually spoke with her start to finish? Because I can't – oh, no, I'm sorry. This was with Total Film. Yep. Okay. So another place to be able to chase down the Fuller interview. But it's – she goes back and forth, and this is just – this reminds me of so many other actors who have taken on the mantle. I think Capaldi was the same way when he first took it on, was sort of flipping back and forth between the feeling honored for the opportunity, feeling the concern, obviously, of having all eyes on you, and then this self-deprecating aspect as well, saying – I'm really nothing special, but I'm going to do my damnedest with this extremely special opportunity, you know, and you got to wonder from anyone else, you might listen to them say that and think, oh, well, you're just, you know, it's false modesty and so forth. But I take this as genuine. Seen of any, like she did the radio interview, I know, what, a month and a half, 2 months back, and was just still agog about the entire thing. And that was genuine. She couldn't even string sentences together. She was just still gaping at the fact that she had had this opportunity. She was just searching for words to even, you know, try and interpret what her brain was telling her was actually happening. But now that she's had some chance to process, again, she's just, you know, she says, there's nothing unattainable about me. I don't look like I've been carved out of rock. I don't sound like I've had the extraordinary glamour. Is she nuts? Is she insane?
Maybe, isn't that part of playing the doctor?
I don't know. The woman's absolutely stunning.
Yes.
She's absolutely beautiful. And her accent and her persona are riveting. I mean, you knew it from Broadchurch. You'd seen it in other things as well. Even when she's playing a meek little character, like in some of the comedy indie films that she's done and stuff, you can't take your eyes off her. So I don't know. I just, it's like you almost want to, lay into her for making a statement like that, the same way you want to lay in to all the little butthurt, salty fanboys who are still raging that this is the demise of Doctor Who.
Oh, God, I've so little time for that. I mean, between that and the people complaining about The Last Jedi, I can't even. It's like, it's funny, you know, you talk about the whole thing that, you know, the element of people saying, well, we're losing a good, positive male role model. I'm thinking, dudes, you know, the first person I saw act heroic in a Star Wars movie was Princess Leia. You know, it's like that's my reference point. And I've been a Doctor Who fan for, you know, well, let's just say long enough to have, kids who are Doctor Who fans, who at least one of whom by law no longer has to listen to me anymore. So, you know, I think that you see with a lot of the actors who get cast, you know, one thing that's apparent, they don't cast dummies for this role. You know, the people, you know, you look at, you know, Eccleston, Capaldi, Whitaker, McGann, looking at just the last couple decades, you know, smart, you know, character actors, you know, I think they have a degree of humility to them. And I think they're also aware that there is that there's always going to be a segment that's looking to take them down a bit. And I think I just sometimes think that they're just saying, they're just being mindful of, hey, you know, you're never as brilliant as your biggest partisan says you are. You're never as terrible as your worst critic. And I think some of it's also just her trying to set a level expectation that, you know, knowing that no matter what she says, someone's going to find fault. So I think she's just maybe just trying to just try to keep things on a level mindset.
Well, I don't think it's going to take long once we have our series proper for a lot of this to shut down, because there's always that percentage of individuals who have to see to believe. They have to hear it to process it. So until they get an opportunity to see her, you know, well, land, first of all, because that's going to be necessary. It's kind of a dangerous proposition to have the Doctor constantly fall.
And how awesome was that cliffhanger? You know, I didn't get to, you know, take part in, you know, last week's, and I was kind of envious of that. But, you know, man, that's an ending of an episode.
There wasn't even a cliff to hang off of.
Right. I mean, it's like, yeah, it's like, we're going to have a cliffhanger, and we'll just destroy the cliff while we're at it.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, and that led to some fantastic discussions, too, because there were all these little, you know, well, let's just call them these D-bags who were saying things like, well, even the TARDIS didn't want her in there and ejected her. Well, I'm pretty sure I remember Matt Smith hanging by his fingernails from the TARDIS door after his regeneration.
And let's face it, we have no idea what happened between the War Doctor and the Nine.
Precisely.
All we know is that TARDIS ended up looking a lot different.
Yeah. Yeah. This is true. Well, so there you have it. So we've got at least in what would otherwise be a relatively slow news week, we have an opportunity to get something redeeming and feel good from Ms. Whitaker's camp. So yeah. Yeah. Pleased about that. Oh, and we are like, dude, we're like, a month and a week, yeah, month and 2 weeks away from Gallifrey One. So, getting extremely jazzed for that. Might even have to start packing soon, because if I don't, then it becomes an extremely chaotic week that week when I realize I haven't. Don, are you you and the family headed out to LA for that one, or is that not on the roster?
Sadly, yeah, sadly, no. I've never been. I need to make it out there because I've got lots of friends, who have made the pilgrimage on occasion. Some going way back to the earliest years. Definitely on the bucket list, but alas.
Because I don't want to pour any salt in the wound, but they did just announce this past week that not only will Stephen Moffat be there, but he'll be joined in a lot of panel discussions by Brian Minchin. So the two of them now will actually be discussing all of their creative processes that went into the last few seasons.
Okay, that doesn't sting at all. That does not sting at all.
Good.
Ouch. Okay. Ouch. Yeah.
Well, but we're absolutely looking forward to it. And for all the listeners that are going to be joining us out there, we will see you Thursday evening for LobbyCon. We did get some understanding that they're changing around the whole sequence so that the first party night is actually – the first sanctioned party night is actually Thursday night so that they can have time to have their karaoke and all the other things, because they're going to be adding some new evening events over the course of the weekend that they had to actually move the karaoke party to Thursday just to make room for the rest. So
that actually works really well.
I think so. Yeah, I got to agree. But yes, we will see everybody there at the Marriott in about 5 weeks' time. But yeah, that's the only thing on my roster right now. I have a hard time really thinking about anything else at the moment.
It's pretty awesome.
Yeah. Jay, bring us home.
Well, this has been episode 267 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, hey, can you just pass me the fungus? I'm kind of hungry.
Are you sure this isn't beef? And this is Kier saying, I mean, they told me I was too old to take over, they did. But I've been doing this milk round, 53 years, wet or fine, didn't I? Oh, there's life in the old dog yet.
And this is Haley saying, never touch the goo.
And this is Don saying, will you excuse me? I do think I'm going to be wanted on the telephone.
Nice. We'll see you guys next week.
And we'll see.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com. Tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio or on Facebook @facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows at 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1GPR. You should also go to GunnaGeek.com and check out lots of other high-quality geek-centric shows, or visit forums.GunnaGeek.com to talk about anything geeky with us or the community.